The following is a production of University Laboratory High School in Urbana and Illinois Public Media.
We want to ride the bus you ride. We want to use the doors you use. We want to read the signs you read. We want to choose the path you choose. We've got to wake up now. We've got to look and see. Things aren't the way that they ought to be.
When I was younger, I really didn't understand my disability. I knew that I walked funny. My feet turned out to the side. I knew my balance wasn't very good. I got teased a lot. I got stared at a lot. So I didn't have a very good self-image. I didn't like my body. I didn't like me. I didn't like being different. I didn't like sticking out. So it was kind of a tough childhood.
So to go out on a date one night and wake up the next morning and you can't move your legs, there's a lot of adjustment to something like that.
A lot of us saw using crutches and walking upright as an attempt to appear able-bodied and not be who we were. But when you were 3 feet off the ground and sitting down and on wheels, there wasn't any doubt about who you were. And that those people needed to learn to deal with you on that level.
Throughout history, there's always a barrier, and there's always somebody that's saying, no, you can't do that, or no, you can't do this. But those barriers do have breaking points, and it just takes the right people and the right fight, you know, and the consistency to break those walls down.
This is an extraordinarily unique place, and not just unique in its attributes, but unique in its philosophy, the history of the program, the inventiveness of this program in looking at problems of access and creating and building and developing solutions, architectural standards, wheelchair accessible buses, and things that did not exist anywhere else. And that was the extraordinary role of this program, and it that has been hopefully for 60 some years.
Wake up now. We've got to look and see. Things aren't the way that they ought to be.
Throughout history, people with disabilities have faced an inaccessible world, not only through physical barriers, but just as decisively due to discriminatory attitudes. But that began to change after World War II. As disabled veterans began returning from the front lines, they found a new battlefield, confronting the negative attitudes towards people with disabilities.
The Department of Rehabilitation Education Services at the University of Illinois was at the forefront of this fight. Led by Timothy Nugent, it revolutionized the campus and beyond. It created standards for accessibility, paved the way for future disability rights laws, and changed the attitudes of administrators, faculty, students, and the general public towards those with disabilities.
The history of the struggle is presented in Breaking Down Disability Barriers, The Journey Towards Equality at the University of Illinois. I'm Sheila Gogola.
And I'm Catherine Flos.
We've got to wake up now. We've got to look and see. Things aren't the way that they ought to be. We've got to wake up now. We've got to wake up now.
Hundreds of students with disabilities have enrolled at the University of Illinois. The first were World War II veterans injured in combat. But by the late 1940s, the U of I disability program was also home to many students who were impacted by polio.
I had polio when I was about 3.5 years old. Polio was considered the great killer in this country. And before it was understood, people would leave town, leave cities, you know, go out to country during the summer because it seemed like that's when it sprouted up. And so in my neighborhood, as an example of being a great killer, and this is in Orange, New Jersey, it's urban area. And so a neighborhood would be about two city blocks. And in my neighborhood then, there were 17 people that contracted polio about the same time, and only two survived.
My parents saved a newspaper clipping that noted that Brad Hedrick had sustained polio, was in a hospital in Greensboro, and was one of the more severe cases. So my mom, I can still remember my mom even going back years later, remembering that the only thing I could move was my eyeballs when I was in the hospital.
I'm told that I essentially went stiff as a board from the neck down, and I was that way for 3 days with no feeling at all. After the third day, the feeling came back so that I have full feeling all over my body. I just don't have control of the muscles in my legs.
Parents used to live in fear that their children would get polio because once you got it, there wasn't very much they could do other than just supportive treatment.
In 1955, the polio vaccine was developed, which eventually eradicated its presence in the U.S. However, polio and military service-related injuries were not the only causes of lifelong disabilities.
I was injured when I was 4 years old. I fell out of a 12-story window, actually. Yeah, I used to live in an apartment building in Northern Virginia, and I was in my bedroom. I was supposed to be taking a nap. And, you know, like most mischievous four-year-olds, I wasn't. And I had a pretty wide windowsill in my bedroom. And so I climbed up on the windowsill to get something off of a bookshelf that was next to the window. And while I was walking across, I leaned backwards. And unbeknownst to me, the window was open. And it was back when they used to use pop-out screens. They don't use them anymore because of situations like this, because of liability issues, but they still used them then, and the screen popped out, and I fell. I ended up, you know, smashing my femurs. I dislocated my hips, and I bruised my spinal cord.
My family had a lake lot on Lake Taylorville, Illinois, and we were having a neighborhood picnic, and it'd been a long afternoon, and I ran down a hill across the boat dock and dove off the end of the boat dock, and I had too much momentum, and the water was not deep enough, and I hit my head on the bottom of the lake, and that snapped my neck back, and it crushed my spinal column. And I never really lost consciousness, but maybe just for a split second, because kind of when I came back to, my forehead was still scraping across the sandy bottom of the lake. I kind of felt like a disabled submarine.
This was 2 years ago, and I was riding my bike from Aurora to Chicago, and on the way back, I was riding down the highway, and I was going pretty fast, like almost 120 miles an hour, and I was trying to get off on an exit ramp, but I accidentally got off on an exit ramp that was a really short exit ramp. And when I got off, I hit the brakes pretty hard, and I fell, and I hit my neck on a curb. So basically, I fell off my motorcycle, and I broke my neck, and I kind of blacked out from then on. And then I woke up in the ambulance, and I was thinking, like, oh my God, I can't move. Like, I can't feel anything. And basically, I was just, like, screaming. I knew that I was paralyzed at that minute.
The doctors told my parents, just move on with your lives. This child is better put away, he'll only bring you strife. Think of the other children, a burden to you all. We have a place for such as him behind the prison walls.
Throughout much of the 20th century, growing up with a disability was difficult. Children with a disability were not expected to live at home, but in an institution. Those that did stay at home were often excluded from the activities of their able-bodied peers due to inaccessibility or discrimination.
I know I had a friend in college. she had a brother who was born with cerebral palsy, and the first thing the doctor said is, well, you don't want to take this baby home. You want to send it to the institution. Don't even take the baby home. Send it right to the institution. I mean, that was kind of the thinking back in the 60s and 50s, if any kind of physical impairment. I think even growing up at that time, families who had people who had some type of impairment, that was kind of considered black mark on your family. Those children were hidden. People probably didn't even want to send them to school.
At the time, sometimes families, if they had someone with a disability, no matter what it was, they thought they were being punished by God sometimes. And sometimes they were shunned and made to stay in the house. And in that case, they didn't get education. They didn't have any experiences.
They thought you were a safety hazard. You know, your crutches would be getting in somebody's way, and they would be tripping on you, and so forth. And it was just a very common perception. I don't know. That just goes back to the old days, I guess, where people were supposed to be perfect, and if you weren't, you were supposed to stay hidden.
The fact that there were no elevators, there were no curb cuts, there were no ramps, there were very few jobs that educationally the superintendent of schools thought it would be best for me to go off to a school that had no rigor whatsoever because I had a physical impairment. But you got to remember, I was born in the 50s. There were a lot of attitudes at that time that were stereotypical and bigoted and biased and based on imagined attributes rather than real attributes. I mean, I was born in a context in which there were water fountains that were labeled colored and white, and bathrooms that weren't male and female but were colored and white, and that folks of color ate in restaurants, in backroom counters. I mean, my assessment was there are a lot of people that are being shafted in this context. It's not just people with disabilities. I could see a lot of parallels between the experience that people with disabilities had and the experience of African Americans.
Before 1973, when Congress passed the Rehabilitation Act guaranteeing equal education, children with disabilities routinely faced discrimination at able-bodied schools, or they were sent to schools for the disabled. But many families refused to accept subpar educations for their children and successfully battled unjust attitudes.
At the time, there was perhaps a de facto segregation type of thing. The norm was that there were schools for different disabilities. And so all the kids with a certain disability would go to one school. Another school, maybe for visually impaired students, they would go to that. For ones that are cognitively impaired, they would go to that school.
When it came time for me to go to school, they wanted to put me in the special class, and my mom said absolutely not. It's his body that doesn't work, not his mind. And you have a brand new school that is all on one level, and there's absolutely no reason why he shouldn't go to school with his classmates. And she said he either goes or I'll sue the county. So I went.
When I showed up at the first day at school with these exoskeletal, you know, Iron Man appliances that I had at that time, with crutches and braces up to my waist, you know, there was a concern on the part, you know, at that time by the superintendents that there were about 8 steps into the school, then maybe it would be better if I went to the accessible special school. My parents were not about to accept the special school for the kids with disabilities. They were dedicated to ensuring that my life and my academic experiences were normalized, that I had the most rigorous training academically as possible. And the interesting aspect of that school, that special school, it was architecturally accessible, but I don't think it had more than one certified college-trained teacher in the building. And I think it speaks volumes about the inability of that day of administrators to conceptualize how they could deal with disability.
I unfortunately ran into some teachers who really didn't quite understand students with disabilities. My sophomore year, day one of an English class, it was an honors level English class, and she right there in front of the entire class said, you know, you're a major inconvenience to me. You shouldn't even be in an honors level English class. You should be in the special ed room. You're not going to college anyway. And I mean, what do you say to that? You know, it sort of catches you completely off guard and you're like, whoa, you know? And I mean, I wasn't okay with all of this. I came from a house where, you know, my parents are very strong advocates for me, but I also realized, you know, this is my life. What these people at this school were telling me what I could and couldn't do.
I remember my mom telling me once that when I was in first grade, they wanted to put me in the developmental disability group. You know, my mom said no to that. We're not doing that because I don't have any developmental disabilities. But as I aged, they tried to still kind of stick me with certain stigmas. And I would say that everything that I had to fight for, all my education, all my accommodations. But me fighting the system, at least where I live, it changed the system. And now they don't do stuff like that for future kids. I'm glad to know that the struggles I went through, people now don't have to as much.
Many people acquired their disability later in life due to spinal cord injuries. While they did not have to face the trials of growing up with a disability, they had the challenge of adjusting to their new capabilities.
And I remember distinctly when I went back to high school, second semester, sophomore year, everybody knew Jean up and walking around. And that's the only way I knew myself. And when I got back to school, I wasn't comfortable with my wheelchair, and I wasn't able to help other people be comfortable with the wheelchair. People would talk to me with their head down, their eyes down. They wouldn't give me eye contact. Some of them, quote-unquote, felt sorry for me. I didn't want them to feel sorry for me. I just wanted my friends back.
I do remember being very nervous about going to class the first few times, just wondering about, you know, what people are going to think, or, you know, are people going to accept me like they would accept somebody else who wasn't in a wheelchair.
You grow up and you spend so much of your time concentrating on your activities out of school. I mean, in a small school in Southern Illinois, there weren't any programs like this. You went to school, you took your classes, you went home, and you played with your friends. And so it was playing basketball, and it was go swimming in the creek, and it was getting on a baseball team and running track, and it was that kind of stuff. And so to go out on a date one night and wake up the next morning and you can't move your legs, there's a lot of adjustment to something like that.
Haven't had a dream in a long time. See, the life I've had can make a good man bad. So for once in my life, let me get what I want. Lord knows it would be the first time. Lord knows it would be the first time.
Many people with disabilities wanted to earn a post-secondary degree, but it was difficult to find accessible universities in the 1940s. Returning World War II disabled veterans demanded they be allowed to use their GI Bills to receive a college education. At the University of Illinois, Dr. Timothy Nugent responded to the need, opening a disability service program in 1948 and putting the U of I at the forefront as one of the most accessible schools in the nation.
I came down from the University of Wisconsin to the Galesburg campus of the University of Illinois in the summer of 1948, and that was a unique facility. It was an Army General Hospital, a brand new one, that was no longer needed because the war had come to an end. So the university rented it from War Assets Administration to create an undergraduate division to accommodate all the returning veterans who would want to go to college. I envisioned the opportunity to work with these people with various causes and manifestations of disability to make it possible for them to get a higher education. But I learned quickly that they needed more than just schooling. They needed experiences that were competitive. They needed experiences that were social. I developed them as I recognized a need for them, and it evolved into a multifaceted program.
That Nugent could imagine a reality in which young people with disabilities in wheelchairs could go to college and graduate and get jobs and have families and live productive lives and successful and enjoyable lives, that was a unique vision in 1948. And the world was not configured either philosophically, conceptually, architecturally, programmatically, was not configured to support that vision.
Funding and advocates for the Disability Services Program were scarce. Timothy Nugent had to work hard to find facilities and financial support for disabled students, often clashing with university officials and community members.
Well, when I came there, it was tar paper shacks as they were in there. They had oil heat. It was cold in the winter, and it was hot in the summer. I can remember going in the winter, and because there was ventilation on the south side of the building there, and our therapy tables were next to that, and you'd brush the snow off of the therapy tables in order to open up in the morning. Things weren't ideal, but they made do.
Nugent had to be an entrepreneur. I mean, he built something from nothing because he had to come up with his own budget for about 7 or 8 years, and it was his passion, zeal, and creativity that made that possible. I would be the first to say that I'm not sure I would still be at Illinois if I had to come up with my own budget. So I have great reverence and respect for Tim Nugent for the fact that he didn't take jobs that would have paid significantly more money and had significantly fewer headaches. And those positions were offered to him, and he turned them down. The university administration did not live in a vacuum from society at large. University administration on this campus had the same beliefs about disability that the population had, and Tim fought those battles very successfully, and over time, attitudes changed.
One of the difficulties that students with disabilities encountered was inaccessible classrooms. Timothy Nugent advocated on behalf of his students, demanding that classrooms and other parts of campus be accessible.
The students would all register, and then we would take these registration, and Tim would go through it. And many times the class was on the third floor in a building with no elevator. So Tim had the ability to take that class from that building and move it to a different building if they had the adequate facilities that were accessible there. So at first, many, many, many classes were rerouted to different buildings or different rooms.
There were a lot of people that did not want to have the buildings accessible. They didn't want to go through that. And so that was one of the importance of the program and Tim Nugent that we have, because he negotiated and twisted arms and anything he had to do to get this university on the right track.
Dr. Nugent was intimately involved in putting together the initial standards, architectural standards, for accessibility in the United States. A lot of our alums went on and were significant in writing the legislation that has helped people with disabilities, the ADA included. So when people are walking around Champaign-Urbana and they see a curb cut, something as simple as that, they're actually seeing a part of history that we're responsible for here in this community.
The architectural innovations at the University of Illinois laid the groundwork for the current National Accessibility Guidelines and ultimately the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. This law ensured that people with disabilities have the same rights as all American citizens.
The ADA, they're guidelines. And what it means is that you should do this, but you don't have to. But if you don't, somebody's going to come along and they're going to sue your pants off. And you're going to have to change it. So you might as well do it now. So it won't hurt as much, because in renovation, to renovate things and make things different, it's a whole different ballgame than new construction. It costs a whole lot more. That's what the guidelines stand for.
In terms of disability rights, it was huge because it moved a lot of the things that would be done by public entities like universities and federal agencies and state government to the mainstream. So now hotels and restaurants and public buildings all had to meet the same accessibility requirements that federal government and anybody receiving federal funds had to do. So it's going to open up a lot more opportunities for people with disabilities, allow them to do more things.
One of the most important innovations at the University of Illinois is the Beckwith program. Offering one of the most comprehensive assistance programs in the nation, it allows students with severe disabilities to live on campus while attending college.
Beckwith Hall has a great history. There were four guys, and they wanted to come to school, and they all were quadriplegics. And there was no place for them to live. And so they wanted to come to school so bad, they lived in a nursing home for a year, which was in Champaign, called the Greenbrier. And there was a unit that was closed, and so they lived there, and they arranged with the rehab center to get the bus that would bring them to campus. Well, you know, it didn't take long for them to realize that 20-year-olds in a nursing home was not all that much fun. And so they strived for something better. And so there was a house that's actually still there, and it was rented to these guys as well as a couple more, and they made some real basic renovations. And the personal assistants lived upstairs, and the students lived downstairs, and that became their residence. And that was called Tanbriar. That building was not in good shape at all.
And then what ended up happening is the university got a donation from Guy M. Beckwith. He was a farmer, and he always thought education was important, travel was important. He never got to do either. So he wanted to give money to the university for a different kind of learning environment. And I don't know how it happened, but Tim Nugent was always right there trying to make the best things happen for students on campus with disabilities. And he was able to tell the university, I have a vision for a great residential environment for people with physical disabilities. Why don't we use that money for that? And he convinced the university to do that.
When Beckwith first opened, and this is actually really kind of big, it was under the medical model. Okay, so the staff were all hired and trained by the nurse, by the director. They were assigned shifts, like what would happen in a hospital. The students didn't know or didn't have any input or say of who was going to assist them at all. Mid-90s, when Katherine Johnson, who's now the associate director, showed up, and that model was not working, looked at it and assessed it and said, this isn't working. So she changed it. And so what she did is she opened up that the personal assistants just come in and work with the students when they wanted to. And then the students got to hire and train their own staff and have say of when they got up and went to bed and who was working with them and if it was a male or female or whatnot. So that was huge from a sense of independence.
Coming to the University of Illinois Beckwith program is often life-changing for students with severe disabilities. For many, it means leaving behind trusted caretakers and instead learning how to oversee multiple personal assistants who are now responsible for their care.
I always thought I would go to college, but I thought I would live at home and do it. And I kind of had this big picture in my head that I wanted to move out someday and live by myself or, you know, not with my parents. But I really never knew how that would occur. So it was just kind of this big picture in my head, and I didn't really know how I would get from point A to point B, really.
Some of the Beckwith students, they basically interacted with nobody but their parents for their whole life. You know, they were homeschooled. You know, when they needed to go to the bathroom, they called mom. When they were hungry, they called mom. You know, it was always mom.
At this point, the majority of the residents of Beckwith have had their disability since they were babies, because they either had cerebral palsy or they have a form of muscular dystrophy. So the parents have been the caretakers. Oftentimes, that first night is their first night getting a full night's sleep, because a lot of them need to be turned or need some kind of help overnight. And so it's so scary to think that you're turning over the care that you've been giving to some stranger, and trusting that that they're going to be okay. And then knowing that it's up to the student to learn how to hire and train their own personal assistants. And knowing what a daunting task it is, it's really overwhelming.
I almost left, actually, after my second week. I called my brother because I didn't want to tell my parents, crying, and I was so upset because what's more than brand new was a different type of care, because I was used to nurses taking care of me, and these were people my own age, which was really awkward for me. You know, I felt really uncomfortable, I think. That was definitely like a bad memory, but I kind of emerged myself into my academics, and I just pushed on. I just did it anyway, you know. I don't know how I did it, but I did it, and it got a lot better, slowly but surely.
University of Illinois administrators at Beckwith Hall realize the difficulties that these students face in transitioning from home to an independent lifestyle. They try to assist the Beckwith residents in all ways possible so students can learn to take charge of their own lives.
Our motto at Beckwith is making important choices, leading empowered lives. And you are responsible for every decision you make. You have to make choices that are good for you, that help with your independence. It's telling them you have to start taking responsibility. It's not up to your mom and dad anymore. And we will help you, but we just really don't allow for many excuses. Our definition of independence is not that you do everything for yourself, but that you are capable of making decisions and telling other people how you would like something done for you. Independence for our students is never going to be, for many of them, doing something independent. Many of them are not going to be able to do that. But they need to be able to manage their lives in such a way that they have control over it and they have control over the people who are helping them.
One of the directors, Catherine Johnson, she hires all the personal assistants. And I think we have on staff anywhere from like 60 to 80 personal assistants at any given time. And basically she sends out a PA list. And from that list, you're required to hire as many people you need as to fill your daily slots. So you get 5 hours a day for personal care. So I usually give the person that gets me up 3 hours. And then I have someone cook for me dinner. That's an hour. And then I have someone put me to bed. That's another hour. So you have to hire them through this personal assistant list. And how you train them is I actually just have to tell them what to do. Like I have to tell them, like, hey, you know, my shirt comes off this way. Like my pills are over in that drawer. Can you give them to me? Like, I just basically have to tell them, which can be hard at sometimes, because if you can imagine like not being able to move and having to describe everything to someone, it can be difficult, you know, like it can be hard, but it's doable. And I train the personal assistants like that.
The personal assistants who work at Beckwith Hall take care of the disabled students' personal needs, assisting with activities they cannot physically complete themselves. Often, PAs have never done any sort of personal care, so beginning this work can be daunting. However, PAs often come to enjoy the work and the relations they create with students at Beckwith.
What really scared me is when they started, you know, bringing out examples of all the medical equipment that you would be dealing with, and like things like catheters and leg bags and shower chairs. And then they showed us how to do certain like lifts, and we had to like practice on each other. So all of it was just extremely intimidating. My very first person, I would say he is the reason why I stayed working at Beckwith. I met him during a dinner shift that I was doing, and he's like, oh, well, you know, are you looking for these hours? I need a PA at these times. Are you interested? I said, yes. And so the first day that I get there, and it's supposed to be a shower shift, so I'm a little, you know, nervous. Am I going to drop him? Am I going to do something wrong? Is it going to be weird looking at a male who is naked? You know, like, it was all kind of scary. So I get in there, and he, you know, greets me, says hi. He's like, already? He's like, all right, are you ready? He's like, let's get naked. Like, and I just, like, started laughing so hard. And I knew, like, he was just had people taking care of him for the majority of his life, so he was used to, you know, people seeing him like that. So it, like, wasn't an issue for him, and he made me feel comfortable, so it was no longer an issue for me.
The most rewarding part is just knowing you're a factor. You're an element that's enabling that person realize their dreams. That fact alone is a great thing. I want to say I woke up either three or four people, which included walking a dog. So, you know, you got, you know, people's pets, you got people in their classes. It was a sense of responsibility of holding all of these different factors up, you know. I just want to say that I really embraced the experiences that I had at Beckwith. Beckwith will always have a special place in my heart.
Although Beckwith was considered state-of-the-art when it was first built a quarter century ago, now much of its equipment and technology is antiquated. Given this problem, as well as its poor location on the edge of the University of Illinois campus, administrators moved the Beckwith program to a new location, Nugent Hall, inside Eikenberry Commons.
There's a lot of amazing things going on here in terms of being innovative. Probably the most exciting thing about Beckwith Hall over on John Street is that it's being moved into the new Eikenberry Commons and will now be not only a service of the university, but integrated into the regular housing program, because Beckwith had been a program of the Disability Resources Center. Now it's going to be part in partnership with actual housing and could serve as a model for other universities to help them integrate students with severe disabilities into to their dorm program and make higher education much more accessible to many students.
I think it's good that it's integrating with other kids without disabilities, so that, you know, students without disabilities can gain from the perspective of seeing someone with a disability, and it might broaden their, you know, horizons.
I think it's going to be an excellent opportunity for students to increase their abilities while being independent, because instead of being secluded, you know, kind of street that nobody really goes on except to walk back and forth to class, now you're smack in the middle of all the action on campus. If Eikenberry is having a lot of parties, you know, you're right there to experience it as well. They're actually there with the rest of the University of Illinois students.
The university has not had a new residence hall in over 40 years, so we have an opportunity to look at what community models we want to have in place. How do we help people to integrate and do things together? And hopefully be a model for other universities across the country.
The University of Illinois' disability program began when World War II veterans demanded their right to a college education, and the program continues today to offer assistance to veterans with disabilities coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
A huge issue that's occurring with the Iraq War and Afghanistan is people who would have died in Vietnam because of head injuries are living. And they're coming home, and we do not have the rehab centers or the rehabilitation programs prepared to deal with it. It's been a progression. If you had a spinal cord injury in World War II, your chances of survival were almost zero. Korea, the MASH units, all of a sudden people were surviving, was starting to come out, especially the amputees. But then in Vietnam, with the advent of the helicopter, where all of a sudden people were immediately put on ships and put into surgery bays. And if you had a spinal cord injury, you had a pretty good chance of surviving. And now, with the Iraq War and what we're facing, just catastrophic injuries, from burns to head injuries, you name it, they're surviving. And are we ready to deal with it?
I think the challenge of polyimpaired veterans. I think that's an area that we have more questions than answers, and that these Gulf War veterans that are returning with a very significant and multiple disabilities, particularly brain injury is a condition that higher education has very little experience with, as they come back and want to use the new GI Bill to go back to school, a growing number of them are going to have brain injury. And we're going to have to learn how, just as we had to learn how to serve these veterans when they came back in wheelchairs, we have a lot of questions we need to be able to answer to effectively serve these young men and women that come back with brain injuries. And again, to brag on my institution, on the University of Illinois, there is an effort now to work in seeking federal support, state support, private support to redeploy the current Beckwith Hall, remodel, update, and then redeploy it as a facility to serve veterans with polyimpairment. And coincident with that will then be, of course, developing the research programs with scientists from this campus to look at what interventions are most effective in accommodating these veterans and facilitating their success in higher education and their success in learning to most effectively manage life with their impairments.
Technology has always been of great assistance to people with disabilities on their path to independence. The most obvious example is the wheelchair. In the 1950s, manual wheelchairs were meant to be pushed by an assistant, making the device impractical for people attending school, working at a job, or competing in athletics. In its early years, the disability program at the U of I pioneered faster, more streamlined models that could be used towards a more independent lifestyle. Today, wheelchair technology and other technological advances have made it possible for people with disabilities to live independently.
Adaptive equipment is improving all the time. Wheelchairs are becoming more and more reliable. There's wheelchairs now that will climb steps. There's wheelchairs that will elevate. The seat level will elevate so you can be at eye level with people who are standing and talking. Or if you're at a sporting event and the people in the rows that in front of you are standing up, you know, you can elevate your chair and be at the same eye level as they are. So, yeah, things are still improving day by day.
I'd say, like, my biggest friend is the iPhone because I can't press buttons with my hands. Mm-hmm. And I basically just tap down on this button and I can, you know, use a computer through this iPhone. Like, I can use this as a mouse and use it as a keyboard and type things like onto the computer screen through wireless internet. I also have a program I use called Dragon Naturally Speaking that allows me to speak into the computer and then it just types my words onto the computer. Different technologies like that as far as using the computer just help me go to school.
I think technology is empowering and frightening at the same time because it changes so rapidly. And often, still today, access is not criterion that the developers are using as they come up with these new toys and new software. When you look at the exponential growth in the advancement of new technologies, you cannot fix all these technologies once they're out the door. We have to be able to change the knowledge, understanding, and willingness of manufacturers and developers to consider universal design as a criterion in the development of their products.
Probably one of the first projects I got involved with was working with students over in the law school who were blind. And at that time, they were using electronic databases called LexisNexis. And it was clear to students that the access wasn't very good. It would often take students 2 to 3 times longer to access the same information, often at less quality. They had to memorize a lot of keystrokes to try to find information on topics. And so you might say, well, that's just tough, you know. But, you know, when these law students graduate, you know, what do? In most law firms, they work for a partner doing research. At that time, it cost $100 or $200 an hour to access these systems. And if you look at, you know, a student who is taking 2 to 3 times longer using these systems, you might say, wow, if I was looking for employing this person, you know, you're going to cost me twice as much to access, it's going to take twice as much time to access these systems. You know, that could be thousands of dollars in a week. So it was going to be a severe employment disadvantage. I saw this technology.
Studying at the University of Illinois is only one step in a student's journey to adulthood. One of the goals of the Disability Services Program is to prepare students for future employment. Historically, people with disabilities have faced employment discrimination. Under the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, people with disabilities became protected by law against employment discrimination. Employers are required to offer their employees accommodations if necessary. Even with these laws, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities is almost 2 times as high as for the able-bodied population.
It was very, very difficult to get a job because they thought you couldn't do anything. That was a real problem because they just kind of didn't want to take a chance on you, because then they would feel so terrible if they had to fire you because you weren't capable, and they just assumed, because I do remember applying for a job. I was applying to be a dispatcher for a taxi cab company. Told me they tried to hire someone who had lost one leg and he didn't work out, so they couldn't hire me. And I said, but, you know, I wouldn't be using my feet on this telephone. But that didn't really make any difference. It was very, very hard to get a job in those days.
The first interview I was called for was in the undergrad library. And I went to an interview there, and it went very well. And then 2 days later, I got a phone call back, and they said, we'd like you to come for a second interview. And I thought, well, this is odd. So I said, okay. And I remember the day of that second interview, it snowed all the night before. There was like 1.5 feet of snow. But I dragged myself there. I got there on time. And they said, we want to see you perform a few little tasks. And I thought, oh, all right, they didn't believe me that I could do what I said I could do. So they had me push a book cart, and I was able to do that. And then they wanted to see me get a catalog drawer down out of the cabinet. And, of course, this back before anything was computerized, so I showed them that I could indeed reach the top drawer of the shelves, you know. And then they thought they had me. They took me to Stacks, and they said, they pointed at the top shelf, and they said, would you get that book down for me? And lady's kind of giving me this smarmy grin. I didn't like much like her, and she didn't like me. And it was obvious. So I reached behind in my backpack, and I was never without my pair of extendable tongs. I didn't go anywhere without them. I snapped those puppies out, and I reached up, snatched the book down, grabbed 2 or 3 more down for her, and said, here, will that do? Do I have the job now? She kind of gave me this look, and luckily, the lady who I was actually going to work for was with us, and she just kind of gave me this grin as if to say, yeah, all right. Took care of that business. So I got the job. And after that, there was never any more monkey business about that. And I mean, you know, I looked at her and I said, I'd have to have been a darn fool to have told you I could do a job and not been able to do it. Because, I mean, you'd have found out darn quick. And, you know, why waste my time and yours? So, but that was the only time I ever had a problem, was that initial. Once they knew I could do what I said I could do, never looked back. I went on. I ended up running the department I started in.
When you go into like a job interview with an employer and you don't necessarily have the same physical skills as someone else does, like, you have to make that really aware, and you have to be careful about how you word certain things. Like, an employer will try to say, like, can you do this? Like, can you, you know, write this document? Can you, you know, write a report if I need you to? And I have to be like, yeah, well, I can do it if you transfer it onto the computer, and then I can write it on the computer.
Last time I read recently, I believe it's less than 33% of people with a physical disability work a full-time job. That's a major issue for this country. I think that we're contributing in our little way to put people into the workforce, but I think that it needs to be something that we need to push even harder. And that's where someone like Brad Hedrick has been a mover and shaker in that business in getting people into the university and making that a major emphasis and getting people with physical disabilities into the labor force.
Our society is so used to seeing people with disabilities functioning in society now that maybe they don't think about that it does take an extra level of effort and management to be functional in society with a disability. But because we are a country with resources and we can afford to make those investments.
Well, the cards I've drawn to rough and dark, I straighten my back and I'm working on a dream. I'm working on a dream. I'm
Currently, there are about 50 million Americans with disabilities. The University of Illinois, through its pioneering work, has opened the way to many of the rights and opportunities those Americans enjoy.
When I arrived at the University of Illinois, there were higher expectations placed on me. Disability could no longer be an excuse for anything because the coaches had physical disabilities, and the people who were becoming lawyers and who had won Olympic gold medals, they also had disabilities, but they didn't limit themselves. There was a whole nother level of success for which I could strive. It was once I arrived in Champaign-Urbana that I finally realized our biggest limitations are the ones we place on ourselves or the ones we allow others to place on us.
I think the biggest thing for me is to teach people to be their own advocates. I think that it's just empowering, and it just makes you feel like you're more in charge of your life. And I think that that's a big thing that DRES tries to teach. You know, they don't do things for their students. They assist their students in doing things. Same with Beckwith. They're trying to promote independence, promote people to really make their own choices and not, like, make choices for them or just do what their parents or something think that they should do. So I think that's been a big theme during all of my time at the university.
I feel very fortunate to have had the experiences that I did at the university, which gave me the wherewithal, I guess, to have confidence in myself so that I was able to partake fully of opportunities that society has to offer, and been able to live the life that I did.
I know in my heart, I would say that looking back again, I never thought that I would be where I am today, maybe 5 years ago. You know, in high school, I was always trying to hide it. But nowadays, if you're not okay with my disability, then we probably shouldn't be friends. And, you know, if you're not willing to help me if my arm falls or my head falls or if I need to be helped, then we probably shouldn't be friends. So I think that they've helped me because they've accepted me for who I am.
A lot of people aren't sure or aren't aware of the fact that if you have a disability, there still are a lot of things that you can do. People with disabilities can be independent. People with disabilities can be intelligent. People with disabilities can do all sorts of things that sometimes people don't realize they can do. In my mind, walking is overrated. Walking is really handy, but it's not the only way to get around in life. And I've always got a place to sit when I'm out and about. So I like to educate other people about how bright my life is, too.
I try to forget that I have a disability myself. As long as I can get to where I want to be, do the things during the day that I want to do, I don't think that much about it. So I don't want other people to think that much about it either. In my daily work at Parkland, I don't think people think much about Rio being disabled or being in a wheelchair. I want them to be more concerned about my point of view or about the projects that I'm trying to work on.
Legislation is not the route to go when it comes to bringing about change. Change is done by associating with people. You know, prejudice comes about through disassociation. Once you get to associate with those people and those things, you come to understand them, and discrimination disappears. Legislation becomes a stick that says you're going to be punished if you don't do it, but it doesn't necessarily change the attitude of the other person. Association is the way to change these attitudes, and I think that's where our students and our graduates have done a miraculous job.
I'd like to see us change the way we value people. I think one of the biggest things we see as a problem in society is how we look at people who are different than ourselves. I think the first thing that people do when they see a person in a wheelchair, as an example, is they think, oh, this person can't walk. This person can't go upstairs. They think of the things that a person can't do. The final step will be something that legislation cannot solve. The idea that every person in society will look and evaluate a person or value a person for their strengths, that's something intangible. That's something in the character of our society. It won't be something that can be legislated. It will have to be something that we will grow towards, something that we will learn.
Sunrise come out.
We hope you enjoyed Breaking Down Disability Barriers, The Journey Towards Equality at the University of Illinois. This program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Catherine Flos and Sheila Gogula, with help from David Bergville, Mary Campbell, Gloria Ha, Leif Haig, Sanjay Koshi, and Trudy Tapadurdi.
Interviews were conducted by students from the classes of 2011 and 2015. Stories were contributed by Mark Chennai, Adrian Dank, Jean Driscoll, Chuck Elmer, Anjali Forber-Pratt, Kevin Fritz, Mike Frogley, John Gunderson, Brad Hedrick, John Hobson, Corey Hyslop, Carl Lewis, Paige Lewis, Jenna Lungero, Pat Malik, Marty Morse, Lola Nosker, Tim Nugent, Carmen Sutherland, and Rio Wilhoor.
The program was directed by Dave Dickey of Illinois Public Media and University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford. For more information on this project, visit our website at illinoisyouthmedia.org.